This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Wednesday, 23rd of March, 2022. And our title for this podcast today is going to be A Dangerous Game. We think it's very interesting to see how the Fed continuously ups the ante in terms of hawkish rhetoric. And we have the market nonetheless rallying. The top coming off a little bit here this morning in this buoyant mood in equities, but there was a strong rally yesterday. It begs an explanation. And the only explanation we can come up with prior to that, we're looking at short squeeze, et cetera, but it really does just suggest the Fed has yet to catch up to the curve. As I put it in my FX update yesterday, I think the Fed is chasing a runaway train, chasing from behind, still behind the curve, apparently. And at some point, it's going to catch up. And in the meanwhile, it is a very dangerous game because the Fed has to catch up, and it will catch up. But at what point? Is that today? Is it not for another few weeks? Is it not for another 200 basis points more of tightening? That's the difficult part to unpack. We'll be talking more about that later. Briefly, before I hand it over to you and your impressions, Peter, I just wanted to note that we had yet another couple of Fed speakers out yesterday. Mester, who is a voter from the Cleveland Fed, she was out saying she's now in favor of 50 basis points. She was a bit waffly on that idea before and favors a Fed funds rate of 2.5% by the end of the year. The market, while it has accelerated its pricing and moved higher in its expectations, is still at 2.25%, so it's below that. Bullard will also be out speaking today, but he's also been out speaking and favors the 3% level by year end, multiple 50 basis point hikes to get to that level. And he'll be out speaking again today. And he was the dissenter at the meeting last week. So, yeah, and you're shaking your head, I know, at this market a little bit as well, Peter, but it is a very interesting dynamic. And I think it just speaks to the risk of more volatility. And once the reversal comes, it could be quite spectacular. At least that's my view. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's right now we have a rally that is pretty strong. As you also indicated on slide 2, S&P 500 futures, we have technology stocks, so the Nasdaq 100 leading those gains, as you can see now across our theme basket. So we had a day yesterday with the winning themes for this month actually being on the being the weakest one. So that's sort of the market we have right now. But as you indicated, it seems like they're hiking till something breaks. And I looked at the financial conditions index yesterday. We talked a little bit about it. And if you look at slide 4, I looked at, so what are the returns when you're above or below a certain threshold? So if you're below 0% on financial conditions, you have a positive return. If you're below minus 0.5, you can see that you have increasing monthly equity returns as financial conditions get looser and looser. So, and then you have the opposite effect as you increase your threshold. So, and right now, by the way, we're at minus 0.25 in this Chicago Fed financial conditions index. So as you can see here, with the current pace, and with Mester and Powell's indications of 50 basis point, and if Powell gets his way and they do an aggressive 94 style-ish rate hikes, which they expect can result in a soft landing. But let's say they do 50 basis point in May and June, then by summer we'll be for sure, I think at least very, very much above the average, so above zero on these financial condition index. And I think that will be a very tough bag to hold for equities. And I think we're getting to some kind of a breaking point. And I think the 100-day moving average right now, obviously short term, technically is the key resistance area to watch in the S&P 500.
Yeah, I'm glad actually you mentioned that, because I did want to mention, I know in previous podcasts I've mentioned the 4550 level as the 61.8% retracement. That is on the cash index, which does not have that entry or overnight spike from the Russian invasion of Ukraine as extensive as it was in the future. So if you take the future, it's 45.30, and that perfectly coincides with that 100-day moving average you mentioned, at least on the June S&P future. Again, that chart on slide 2. So yeah, certainly a near-term resistance level to watch to see if the resistance comes in at that level. And then briefly, just on the thoughts about the yield curve, we've talked so much about it. We have the nominal yield curve getting close to flat. And there are different ways to look at the yield curve, as some clever people on Twitter and elsewhere have been pointing out. And one of those ways to look at it is in terms of real yields, the real yield curve, if you will, and I have some perspective on that on slide 3. took a chart from this at Michael Sarwe on Twitter. He's a Nordea strategist with a clever way to illustrate what's going on. So if you take the real yield curve for the 5s 30s in the US, that's the red line on that chart on the left, and it is still quite steep. In other words, there is a built-in assumption here that inflation levels will drop, and I further illustrated that with the 2, 5, and 10-year break evens on the right. So these are the levels that where you break even on the nominal on an inflation linked bond at these different inflation levels for the 2s, 5s, and 10s. And you can see that there's a built-in assumption that this inflationary episode is going to fade and fade hard. So therefore, those lower long yields look less low in real terms. That's the only message out there. So in other words, the inversion might have to be more profound for it to really invert. Either that, we're going to need to see inflation coming down really hard here to justify this, what the yield curve is at. But we need to get to commodities, because commodities are an important driver in this market. Oil prices semi-stable at very high levels. Oleg, I saw some news of a Russian pipeline being shut down for supposedly for some kind of repair. But what's the latest there? And where else are you focusing here on these commodity stories, especially linked to what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, we are most certainly primarily focusing on the risk of supplies from Russia being curbed even further. We got a EU and NATO meeting in Europe, in Brussels tomorrow, where they're going to discuss additional sanctions. The focus is, from a commodity perspective, is most certainly on EU joining the US oil embargo on Russian imports. This will have a significant impact on Europe. We have to remember we buy more than half of Russia's export. It's around 3 million barrels a day. And we can see on the prices here on slide 6 that Russian exports is already suffering. It's trading around $30 below Brent, basically meaning that Indian and Chinese buyers are picking up bargains right now, which they most certainly will continue to do. But Europe will be facing a problem. I put in here on slide 7 as well. It's a brilliant infographic from S&P Global, basically just highlighting where Russian crude goes to. And as you can see, Europe is a major buyer. And what will this, if they do come with this decision, then we also have to look at what the IEA looked at, came out the suggestion last week, basically a 10-point plan to cut oil use. Because if we do cut off Russian oil supplies to and fuel supplies to Europe, we need to do something ourselves. We need to cut demand dramatically. And they came out with several suggestions. Just to mention a couple: work from home 3 days a week, reduce the speed limit on motorways, car-free Sundays, making public transport cheaper, carpooling, avoid business travel, promote efficient use of freight trucks and goods delivery, and so on. It's a 10-point plan, and they estimate that it could reduce European EU demand by 2.7 million barrels, more or less what we pick up from Russia. So we've seen some dramatic decisions being made during the past month following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So I suppose we cannot rule this out, that we are potentially facing a period of pain in Europe, which I suppose at the end of the day is a price worth paying for this stance that we're currently making.
Yeah, and other news linked to all of this is, of course, the concern around the food situation because Ukraine is a top wheat exporter. I think you have some news on that front as well.
Yeah, we had the Ukraine agriculture minister out yesterday, basically with some dire prognosis for the coming season. They are cutting their spring crop sowing area by half to 7 million hectares from 15 million. Due to the hostilities, they're also saying that the corn acres could fall to 3.3 from around 5.4 million hectares in 21. The winter harvest also already in the ground. They probably will have to abandon some of that just simply because it's grown in hostile areas. So that could be down to 4 million hectares harvested from 6.5. And all this is just adding to the stress that we're seeing in the grain market. We're seeing the soybean contract in Chicago getting close to the 10-year high. We have to remember that soybean is used to produce oil and meal, and the oil is used not only for food consumption but also by by increased focus on fuel, because oil prices are as high as they are. So that's an additional corner of demand. In addition, sunflower exports from Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of sunflower oil. At the same time, we already have problems with palm oil production in Malaysia, where prices are at a record high. And even adding to that, we also got some impact from Canada. So all in all, we just have to expect that these prices will stay elevated for a long period of time.
And as we talked about on internal call as well, we have France out, seems to be on its front foot more than other countries. At least Macron is making quite an impression on this front with these warnings about the food supply, discussing, I can't remember the exact nature of the suggestion, but basically limits almost like ration cards on some food items. Very interesting to see that signal. Let's hope he's wrong, but I don't know what it'd be interesting to see if this type of concern spreads, because it's not something you'd like to contemplate.
No, exactly. And also, John, in Europe, we have, due to reforms and various environmental issues in recent years, there are large areas of arable land around Europe which has not been sown on and used for a number of years. And there's also talk about basically making an exemption for a period of time, just allowing farmers to increase the acreage that they're planting. That also is something that we need to watch. And also, in addition to that, we got the prospective planting report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture on the last day of the month. That should give us an idea about how U.S. farmers will respond to these higher prices in wheat, whether they're going to add some additional acres to wheat sowing planting this season.
Yeah, I would hope as well some of this biodiesel ceases to exist, but that would then in turn potentially pressure fuel prices as well on the fuel side of things. It's all interacting with each other, these different angles on the commodity situation. Let's have a look just briefly at the FX situation, which is very much driven by both. We've had a lot of risk sentiment boost over the last couple of weeks. We've had a 50 basis point rise on essentially all points on the U.S. yield curve, twos out to tens at least. That has helped to drive yen weakness because, of course, that Bank of Japan yield cap we've talked about. And then on the commodity currency side, Aussie has been one of the big winners. That means that Aussie yen has had an unbelievable performance here. You can see that on slide 5 with the FX overview. But to my mind, again, I think as we've indicated, until something breaks on the Fed, this dangerous game, I think this type of price action is just not sustainable over a significantly long period of time. So very interested to see once two-way price action develops what the nature of that price action will be, particularly if risk sentiment goes off or the officialdom in Japan steps in, because they don't like the disorderly moves here in the FX rate, despite having last Friday been very nonchalant and very dovish at that Bank of Japan meeting. Okay, let's come maybe down from the clouds here, the 10,000 foot view, and have a look at some specific equity stories in this market. I guess we can follow up on a name or two we were mentioning yesterday, Peter, the Adobe story in particular, after they reported earnings after the close yesterday.
Yeah, so they were up 3%, or their shares were up 3% in the primary session, and they gave up all those gains in the extended trading as the company showed, I would say, revenue and earnings pretty much in line with estimates from the last quarter. But it was the outlook that was a little bit tad disappointing. They mentioned on the earnings call that they're seeing an increased competitive landscape, and they're doing a big overhaul of their pricing structure, the first one since 2017, if I remember correctly. So that, I think, spooked a little bit of spooked investors a little bit. But Adobe is still in a very, very strong market position. And I think a lot of the recent decline, which has been pretty dramatic, I think is a reflection of that reduced outlook. But it's it's still a high quality company, and we'll see. I mean, it seems like the competition they're facing is very much introductory part of the product cycle. So it's where you have smaller companies that are looking for having a creative platform for doing certain things, and then they choose some of these Adobe competitors because they are potentially cheaper, more easy to use. But it may, if large companies with very complex needs would still upgrade and use Adobe. And when we also highlighting Nvidia, we're on slide 9, by the way. They had an investor day yesterday, and there's a lot of speculation and talks about whether they would launch into a massive buybacks because of the recent decline in their share price. But the focus, and I think that this is very positive because this is the attitude we need from companies. They were focused on product improvements and new product rollouts. They have something called the Hopper architecture, which is sort of their next generation chips for specifically their data centers. And they were talking a lot about the future and a lot about their products. And I think this is very positive. And I've put in a very nice graphic here for Bloomberg where you can really see how transformational the past 5 years have been for NVIDIA. It's just massive. They have gone from less than $1 billion to almost $11 billion in revenue just from their data center units. So very impressive, to say the least.
And nothing to do with crypto.
crypto is a lot in terms of their recent performance. So I'm glad you mentioned that because that it is that overhang. There is no precise figures. NVIDIA doesn't like to talk about it because I don't think they want to be too much associated with it. But you're right. It is a big part of the growth. How much of it is in the data center segment? We don't know. How much of it is in gaming? It's potentially mixed up in both segments.
All right. And then you're highlighting again, lots of Chinese names on the earnings front as we look at the rest of this week on the next slide 10.
Yeah, Tencent is today. And Alibaba and Xiaomi have just recently announced massive buybacks. So so that's obviously what the market is hoping for, that Tencent will deliver that. It is, as you can see here on slide 10, it's a dramatic change of events over the past little more than a year for Tencent share price. But I think more importantly, if you look at the underlying fundamentals, you can see here that analysts are expecting a little bit less than 9% growth year-on-year for the fourth quarter of last year on a year-to-year basis. And that it's the lowest growth, I think, on record for Tencent since at least 2004. So it's a very different environment. And look at the earnings per share. The expectation is for a decline of almost 20%. So and then I've highlighted General Mills. We have talked about that, but it's because it's a consumer company in the US. I'm very curious to hear about their talks about rising input costs and to what extent they can pass that on to US consumers.
Okay, I was going to dive into a little spiel on the 1994 cycle, which has come up a lot in the discussions about what the Fed is doing. I think I'll save that for tomorrow. I'd like a couple of illustrative charts there. It was a very interesting episode when Greenspan launched into a very aggressive rate hike cycle. But I think we'll save that for tomorrow. For now, let's look at what the latest Fed speakers have to say. We think there is a dangerous game going on where the Fed has to catch up with the market, has to make an impression, and will continue to turn the screws tighter until it does so. We're sympathetic with the view as well that the Fed is looking at financial assets, housing, equity, et cetera, as something they are explicitly potentially targeting to at least slow the gains and possibly even see them correcting lower as a way to lower demand via a negative wealth effect, that this is cheaper to do for the economy and for people's jobs than by tightening rates so much that we start to see the real economy and then people losing their jobs, et cetera, on the ground level. So very interesting to see that, see what they're saying. We have Fed Chair Powell out today. It's the context is a bit not appropriate for making grand comments about the economy. It's a BIS panel. I think a lot of it's on digital currencies, but there is a Q&A. So of course, any comments could be dropped there. Bullard out speaking. We know he's a raging hawk, if you will. In fact, he's out speaking twice. You can see the overview of the macro event risks, by the way, on slide 11. And we have a couple other bits and pieces and central bank speakers, Bank of England Governor Bailey out speaking at that BIS meeting as well, etc. So very interesting to see how that shapes up. And then tomorrow we have these PMIs, the flash PMIs for March coming in from around the world and a few central bank meetings. The Norwest Bank is quite interesting given what's going on in energy markets, South Africa, etc. So let's see how this all shapes up and stay careful out there. And we'll be back tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.